Okay, we're back on another session here, Dr. Zero Trust, I don't know, show or whatever the hell this thing is, but I do it repeatedly and no one's told me to stop doing it yet. So I'm talking with Andrew and Mike, who are remoting in all the way from Australia. It was I had a life achievement today. I got to say g'day to somebody, so that was kind of cool. But if you guys wouldn't mind, give just a quick run through on who you are and what you do, and then we'll start having a conversation.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mike. So Andrew Abel, I'm an Australian-based Zero Trust consultant. Worked in a couple of different sectors in the Australian market doing Zero Trust designs and implementations, and previously cybersecurity strategy for enterprise.
Mike Lowy, I'm an enterprise software developer from way back. I built a software development agency, sold the business, and then finally came out to build my own products. Now I'm a co-founder of Tide Foundation, where we're kind of innovating in new technologies, new cryptography to solve some of the biggest trust problems we have in our digital world.
So let's explore that. When you talk about some of the bigger trust problems, like, let's lay the groundwork for where you see the trust problems in the space. You and I were chatting before about kind of the issues we have around, you know, I guess you'd call it intrinsic trust, or trust that we still have in the human. Andrew calls it the carbon side of things. I mean, how do we eliminate that?
So eliminating it, I guess, is the extreme, the goal. So I don't feel that there's an issue with the methodology, with the philosophy of Zero Trust. It makes a huge amount of sense. But what you find in reality is that today, any Zero Trust architecture, if you kind of follow that chain down the line, there's always these vestiges of authority that sit inside of some system, usually like an identity and access management system or something of that nature. And inside of that system, you'll have a root certificate, or you'll have super users. And these people and these things have basically godlike authority. So when that's the thing that is basically the final decision maker of, yes, you can access this resource, yes, you can open this door, whatever that decision is, if that thing is sitting somewhere on something available to someone, it's always vulnerable. And one way or another, the big attack vectors that we're seeing, the big mass data breaches, are effectively compromising those concentrations of authority through an unwitting system administrator, or through a layer of software that again human beings have access to because they administer it. So it's those kind of final pieces of authority that live inside of those core systems that enable Zero Trust that are an Achilles heel that exists, you know, across the board, and that's the area that we're addressing.
And so for the non-geeks that do listen to this, the three people that have nothing else to do, like when we're talking about root certificates, like what's the risk there? And I mean, I know I'm leading the witness, but I have to make sure we color with crayons with some of this, because root certificates are something where folks don't really see, like, oh, a certificate. Okay, cool. Like, explain a bit of the risk with that.
So think of it as a key, a master key that when someone today authenticates to a system, you log in with a username, password, even if you're using second factor or 10 factors of authentication, there is a system that decides whether you're okay or not. And then once that system has decided you're okay, it then decides what resources you have access to. And the way it typically does that is by using a cryptographic key or signing something so that you only have access to those resources. Now, if you were to steal that key, that master key, you effectively have the keys to the kingdom. You can yourself open up any resource in the organization. And we're seeing that, for example, actually a really good example, and this is maybe a technical example, but I think it kind of demonstrates the problem really well, is supply chain attacks like SolarWinds, where you have an amazing piece of software that's being used by, you know, enterprise organizations, government departments, Now, that piece of software is sitting on your network. It's monitoring everything that's going on. And when that software needs to update with a new security patch or an improvement on the technology, the only reason your organization knows to trust that piece of software is because it's been signed by a key that only SolarWinds has. So that kind of the authority that says, I can trust that piece of software, I'm going to do the update. And all this, these processes are automated. So when someone, a state actor, stole that key, inserted malicious code in the software update, signed it with that master key, everyone trusted it because it was signed with that key. And it meant that thousands of organizations around the world had basically this malicious piece of software sitting right on their network, exfiltrating information for years before it was even discovered because it was signed with that key. So those keys, think about it as a master key. That's those are the things that today need to sit somewhere in a way that, you know, we put walls and moats and everything else around it, but at the end of the day, there's always someone that has access and they need to be available to in order to perform that signature or open that door or decrypt some sensitive information.
So then, yeah. I mean, that's critical, honestly, to a lot of how a lot of organizations work. So how do you fix that problem and not introduce massive pain for everybody that's in that space? And I mean, cryptography is pretty cool, but cryptography also is something that only the math geeks in the audience listen and wake up for.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I think with existing cryptography, it's not possible. So creating new crypto, and I'm sure you're very familiar with the old adage, don't roll your own cryptography, for very good reason, because if you get one bit wrong, if your mathematics isn't sound, then either you've locked something forever or something you think is locked is not locked. So you don't take on something like this lightly. But what we found is that by innovating in a new area called multi-party cryptography, where you're performing cryptographic operations, but in a way that it's not being done by a single server, but by multiple servers, where each server is performing a small part of an operation but poses no threat to the integrity of whatever that operation is. So that as a concept has opened up a world of opportunity and has the ability to solve some of these big problems and to make sure that these vestiges of authority, these last pieces or like those root certificates or the key that signs your software updates doesn't live in anyone's hands. And we can ask this magic key that actually exists in pieces all over the place, hey, can you sign this for me? And it'll only sign it in a way that whatever workflow process you've designed has been followed explicitly. And every time this key signs, it creates an immutable record so that you cannot be using this key in a way that no one even knows it's going on.
So I applaud you because I know that you're like, it's right at the tip of your tongue is like the B word, the blockchain word, and you haven't like uttered it yet because everybody, when you hear blockchain, they'd immediately go, oh, Jesus, this is I mean, I'm a fan of the distributed ledger stuff. I think that distributed computing side of it is super valuable. And I think that there's a lot of value there. Like I run some nodes on the Indicio network because I see that that's actually, and it's being used. So,
yeah.
I mean, following on to that, Andrew, from your perspective, working with clients doing the ZT work, like how is this being received? Is it this is a pipe dream too far away, or is it something that you think is like, let's do this now? How does that fall together?
Yeah, I think that it's sort of, even though it's probably sounds quite complicated, what's involved and all that's actually beautiful in its simplicity. Like the other thing the appeal that I see is, you know, people used to talk about the network was the perimeter and then it was the identities the perimeter, but now I think with good zero trust it's context and outcomes of the perimeter, you know. So things like this approach where you can just basically so integrate a secure process to get an outcome for a business where you don't actually need any overhead or any input from a security context or people looking at it with security goggles to make the outcome secure for the organization. I think this is the future. And this is the, when you think about the convergence of old IT with cybersecurity and business processes now into one stream where there is no anything other than a secure business process, and that will continue to grow. And for me, the future of Zero Trust is products like this, where the outcome, like business and systems and stuff, has to happen, right, for the business to operate. So things like this, where you just, like I said, integrate it so completely and sublimely with that business process to achieve a secure outcome, I think that, you know, that's the appeal to me for something like this.
Is it foundational, you think, from y'all's perspective, to do Zero Trust, to be able to have this in place? Like, honestly, are you bold enough to make the statement you can't do Zero Trust if this is not part of your methodology?
I think that for me, it obviously depends on what you're, and part of the Zero Trust is what do we do as an organization? What do our processes look like? You know, how tech reliant are we? Do we have, you know, key distribution or software updates? Do we, you know, are we a vendor that does like a mouse update or a hardware update? How does our business operate? But I think for any business that has, you know, keys and with Zero Trust, we're always looking to reduce risk factors wherever we can. And ultimately, you'll come across what's my risk here all the time when you're doing design work. So I think for most organizations, it's definitely a big leg up. I wouldn't say that it's absolutely mandatory probably just at the moment, but for most organizations, you know, it's a big win. Like we see in other sectors of Zero Trust, like you can achieve big wins with some policy stuff against identity. You can achieve big quick wins with some network policy based traffic control that's identity aware. So I think in the other parts of the Zero Trust, this is a big win as well.
Mike, your thoughts?
I would go so far as to say that today, even if you're identity and access management system or your firewall is implementing policies that are sound, the fact that the system that is the guardian of those policies is vulnerable to the same attack vector in terms of, hey, there are a bunch of administrators that have access to this, root access, or even worse, you're using some kind of a cloud provider where there's an army of people in that software supply chain and you have zero visibility. You have no idea how many people have access to it. And we're seeing more and more attacks, whether it's through identity and access management systems or others, where there is even third-party IT companies that are now helping this company scale. And it turns out those people have godlike access to customer business accounts, and they have that authority, they have that access. So when the system that is implementing those policies is vulnerable to the same kind of Achilles heel, then it's kind of almost creating the illusion of security in many respects. Like even if you look at just in Australia in the last however long, we've had our second biggest telco breached, our biggest medical insurer breached, and there's a lot of kind of reflection and excuses being made about these breaches. And yeah, you know, first it's like, okay, well, it's a telco that really, you know, that's not good enough, or it's a health insurer, you know, that really has to be more secure. But it wasn't the banking system, it wasn't a financial institution. And as of 2 days ago, a financial institution was breached and 300,000 identities were stolen in a sophisticated attack. The thing is, it's always this compromising of those authority points that is synonymous with, you know, one form or another with all of those breaches. So until we can kind of remove that Achilles heel, then that soft spot's always going to exist, and it's only a matter of time before it's exploited.
And to be clear, like your position on this is not, let's do this blockchain, I don't know, whatever the hell thing across all of the enterprise and all these crazy kajiggered solutions and whatever else. Your piece is, there are some fundamental like root certificates, admin cred sort of access, whatever, like we're, by leveraging distributed immutable systems, you can keep better control of that and remove or exponentially reduce the risk from that being the continued avenue of compromise. Because I think where a lot of folks go sideways in this is they go, oh, well, we're going to do distributed ledger or use the B word. And all of a sudden it's like for everything everywhere all the time. It's like, no, that's you're biting off the apple in like one giant bite, and that's not a smart way to do things. You'll choke.
Yeah. Yeah. I would actually say it's not the B word for us. It's the D word, decentralization. It's not about a traditional blockchain. We actually use a decentralized network that operates in a very different, infinitely scalable way.
And there are distributed networks that are out there now. Like, I think that that's something a lot of folks, they don't wrap their head around. Like, there's a lot of them. It's not like a brand new, super sexy, cool thing that just showed up yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And they're finding their ways into useful places beyond the, you know, the BS that you know, that's probably the most visible. But I guess from Bitcoin, probably the most visible, the most recognizable decentralized network, there was something that we found that we thought was unbelievable, which is that the system holds no authority. The authority for the system was actually moved to the edges, pushed to the edges in the hands of the owners or the users in the form of these keys. It created a whole bunch of usability problems, but what it meant was that you could trust the system. You knew that you were trusting in mathematics. You didn't have to trust anyone, any single server, any single organization, to know that when you turned your key and said, I'm going to trade this to this wallet, it was going to happen. And if we could apply those principles to traditional IT systems for sensitive processes that, again, not every process, sensitive processes that are core to the integrity of a system, and apply that principle so that, hey, once I'm expecting this authentication to occur, and I want that authentication process to be sacrosanct. I don't want to have to think that someone in the middle of this process can access a password or can bypass whatever factors of authentication at the end of the day, because they're an administrator, they could say, I'm going to log in as this person. Those elements have to be removed, and those are the kind of processes that you can replace inside of a platform. So as you said, we don't approach a bank and say, hey, we've got this amazing core technology, just integrate this into your 6,000 different systems and then you'll be really secure. We work with platform developers. So those developing the CRM, the password manager, the ERP system, and we effectively remove them to a large extent as a supply chain risk to their customers, where they can offer a guarantee that, hey, even our most privileged employees don't have access to your sensitive information. The authority over the data that we hold sits outside of our organization, outside of our platform, in a verifiable way. So you can actually verify the integrity of the security the same way that our developers can, our IT administrator can, or even your end customer.
I think that's a really important point that I'm glad we're getting to now. For me, like, you know, say as a Neville nobody, you know, I want to get a new phone contract, or I want to get some other health insurance, and I've got to provide my data to some big faceless corporation. And I'm concerned about that these days because of all these breaches, and something like Tide, where I've got that little bit more peace of mind where I go, well, I know if I provide information, because they're in the organizations are sort of stuck in the middle as well between what they actually need to keep, what they do and don't want to keep, and how they've got to protect it. So nobody's sort of winning at the moment, but me as a customer being able to say, well, you know, if I put my information in here, or if I sign up with this type of password or whatever, at least I've got that peace of mind that Tide's behind it, and I know that no one has access to my password, or the likelihood of my personal data being taken is reduced, you know. So I think that, and that will be a growing trend over the next 18 months. So I do think that's an important part of what Tide has to offer from a completely outside the corporate view and the zero trust piece as a just, you know, like I said, a Neville on the internet.
Do you feel like the Australian market is a bit more open to this sort of approach than it is the US or others, or have you had a lot of those conversations around, you know, this being something that gets broad market adoption? Because I know when I talk to folks, ZT, I think we're probably at a place where we can have that conversation. They don't laugh me out of the room or throw something at me, but like the distributed side of this and the value proposition seems like it's probably still a bit ahead of the market, to be perfectly honest. Like, so how does that work out in Australia?
From our perspective, we are, although we're based in Australia, we're primarily working with global companies, so big So we work with NTT Global, for example. So of everything that they do, one of the things they do is they're one of the largest systems integrators in the world. So they're the ones that will kind of build and manage IT systems for large enterprise organizations, government departments. So they'll set up your Cisco firewall, your Okta identity and access management system. And it's very clear to them and increasingly so to their enterprise customers that no matter how much money they're spending on security, they're basically just bracing for that big breach, that their brand is going to be the next one in the news. So that is pretty unanimous in terms of that recognition of the inevitability of the breach. And existing technology, existing solutions, no matter how much money you're pouring into it, are not removing that risk. They're kind of just delaying the inevitable. And so introducing something that is a new approach is being very well recognized. So NTT have been putting us in front of enterprise clients across a range of different verticals. And we're finding use cases for that capability in platforms being used. Initially, we were kind of exploring more of as a privacy preservation mechanism, a mechanism so that to protect PII and sensitive consumer data. But we found use cases all the way through to protecting critical infrastructure. So if you think of an energy company where you used to have this closed OT network that only the organization had access to, and now you've got customers with solar panels and batteries plugging into the grid, and the grid's effectively connected to the internet. So how do you manage security when that concept of a perimeter no longer exists? I would say that there's universal recognition that a new approach is needed. Something's missing, and so we're getting a good reception across the board.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting that you're already in there with global organizations, because the developer side of it is something that's a regular point of conversation too. Because I personally think, and maybe I'm way off, but I don't think I'm totally off. Like, most developers don't want to be security people, and most security people don't want to be developers. And we've, for some reason, tried to like mush people into this, do both at the same time thing. And it, anyone that would, just do your job, like that's what we're here for. So being able to remove the issue around the development, introducing the risks and threats, because it sucks too for those poor folks to be shipping code. I mean, that's their job. And then for somebody to be like, oh, there's a massive vulnerability and you started Kaseya. It's like, oh shit. Like, you just point the finger at them. I think it's good if we can do that, and especially the way that you're talking about it. Like there's a lot of sense to that approach of distribution and removing the load on the developer side of it. And I could certainly see where system integrators would be very interested in that, because I mean, for them to say they want to do distributed whatever, they're the SIs. They can do distributed stuff if they feel like it.
Yeah, and you're right. For a developer who is constantly under pressure to push out the next release, you have to cut corners. There's no other way, especially in a startup where by definition you're under-resourced, you're working like mad hours. It's only a matter of time before you make a mistake. And it's not just true for developers, but with developers, I guess the problem is compounded. Or you accidentally upload a key to a public GitHub repository, and that starts a chain reaction that's even more significant. So by making it easily accessible and kind of separating a developer from having to have custody of those keys ever, and saying, "Hey, Tide, spawn this authority over this customer record or this device or this system," in a way that they don't actually have to hold it. They can just say, "This is how you behave. Now go behave like that, but I don't want to actually have to touch it." I remember, Andrew, we were talking about this, and you were saying how liability is for an individual, for someone that has to hold that privilege inside an organization where that person is being chased into their home now.
That's right. Yeah, we touched on before about people who do hold those privileges and how that could be a potential extortion point, or you know, a target, someone who has privilege to an organisation that's in the crosshairs of a criminal gang or a state actor or whatever, to just go after that person, and then that person's in an impossible position, you know. So I think that that's definitely something to be wary of. And you know, we all know about the big organizations that get compromised, but of course underneath all that's real people that either made a mistake, left a port open, put code in, as you said, that was incorrect, or someone owns the service or whatever. So I think anywhere where we can take that pressure away while removing the risk at the same time is a good thing.
Yeah, well, and then you also have the folks that happen to have the keys of the kingdom that get pissed off or don't like their boss or whatever else, that go, you know what, I'm just going to wreck shop, and they publish it to the internet or share the key or whatever. I think, was it Capital One that happened to, where she, I mean, it was kind of comical because they were like, we didn't know this was going to happen, even though she was like in chat channels saying she was about to just wreck shop. And she had the keys of the kingdom. So yeah, I think that that's interesting. I could also see where MSPs, MSSPs would find that sort of approach valuable as well, because then that's one less thing for them to have to manage, maintain, and control.
Yeah, it removes liability from platform, from SaaS platforms, from MSSPs, from those that today have to play their role of guardian. And it also provides trust through removing the need for trust for their end customers and their customers. So it's this weird kind of win-win-win situation.
Trust through no trust. I mean,
yeah.
Right. The less you trust someone, the more you can trust them. I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like we're kind of, if the opposite of trust is not necessarily not trusting. Well, to remove trust, you need to replace that with verifiability. If you can verify something, you don't need to trust it.
Yeah, anyone that had teenagers knows exactly what you're talking about, right? Because every time you trust them, you're like, I better go make sure that actually happened. And then you find out it probably didn't.
Yeah. And that's it exactly. Try and get the assumption out, because every time you share data, you're assuming that the person you're sharing with is going to protect it and do the right thing. And they even have the systems to be able to do that despite the best intentions. So, yeah, like assumptions, I always have assumptions, the enemy of good security. So yeah, if you can remove that, then, and to Mike's point about that liability and everything, it's gold, because of the big thick section of the contract that talks about data privacy and protection and how much they spend on security and breach process and all that can be made much smaller, you know, with a technology like this.
Yeah, reducing risk. I interesting stuff. So, well, I appreciate it. I like to keep these things shorter than 30 minutes because folks got other stuff to do. But it's great to have folks from Aussie, Australia. I don't know. Is that a bad thing to say Aussie? I don't know. Australia.
No, that's all right.
Side of the world, right? I think it's like Sunday afternoon for you guys over there.
It's 2020. 2027. Yeah,
somehow y'all are like 3 days ahead of me or whatever else, but I appreciate y'all jumping on the call. I think we'll have some more conversations here in the near future. Actually, when you're at the stage of letting people get their hands in it, I'd be glad to, you know, demo the product and kind of see how that's off, you know, being used and where it fits in. So Andrew and Mike, appreciate y'all's time and thanks for jumping on.
Cheers. Thanks, Chase. No worries.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Disclaimer, the information in this podcast episode, aka episode, is provided for general information purposes only. By listening to this episode, you understand that this is not specific technical guidance from the host. No information contained in this episode should be construed as security advice from the author, host, or guest, nor is it intended to be a substitute for security advice on any particular subject matter. No listener of this episode should act or refrain from acting on the basis of any information included in or accessible through this episode without seeking the appropriate technical or other professional advice on the particular facts and circumstances that are discussed. This podcast is for informational purposes only. All views expressed therein are those of the host and his guest and should not be considered as being endorsed by nor related to the host or the guest's employers.